Professor B.F. Skinner is very much in the news these days, as who wouldn't be, who just wrote a book announcing that we're going to have to do away with individual freedoms and throw away the superstition of the dignity of man. Mr. Skinner, granted, exercises a special leverage on public opinion, or more precisely, academic opinion. He appears to be by far the most influential psychologist in America and probably in the world. Accepted, if not as the founder of behaviorism, certainly as the man who has done the most to systematize it, and most recently to draw out the social implications of it. Concerning his skills as an experimental psychologist, there is no division of opinion. Concerning his utopian fancies, explained first in his novel Walden 2, now in his best-selling Beyond Freedom and Dignity, there is considerable difference of opinion, it being the position of at least one of his critics, that Mr. Skinner has done his best to take us down the road to hell. I should like to begin by asking Mr. Skinner to spend just a moment on the question, is it your assumption that your program will be accepted by the exercise of free will, or disbelieving in free will, are you talking about something that is bound to happen, would indeed have happened irrespective of whether you had ever written your book?
Yes, I'm sure it's something that I can't say it's bound to happen, but if it happens, it will happen because of a kind of evolutionary process. I believe that we have begun to understand more about human behavior, and that once this understanding is available, we are going to design a more effective culture. Now, we may not do that. Our culture may simply perish because there are reasons why we cannot. I've forgotten exact dates, but I think it was around 1300 that China and the West were quite on a par with technology. China had invented the compass, movable type, and gunpowder. But the Chinese culture did not permit any of this to be used. It was illegal to take long voyages and so on. But the West picked up these techniques, and 300 years later, we had all of Western science and technology and exploration, while China had not moved a bit. Now, that shows what can happen when you have an instrument of power but don't use it. And my argument is that the traditional concepts of freedom and dignity may very well stand in the way of our next step.
I am B.F. Skinner, professor of psychology at Harvard University. I should like to discuss some of the reasons why studying with the help of a teaching machine is often dramatically effective. A third feature of machine teaching is that each student follows a carefully constructed program, leading from the initial stage where he is wholly unfamiliar with the subject to a final stage in which he is competent. He does this by taking a large number of very small steps arranged in a coherent order. Each step is so small that he is almost certain to take it correctly. The fact that each step is very small is important. Even though it may not seem like much of an accomplishment, it is always progress in the right direction.
Well, go make your next choice, be your best choice, and if you're looking for a boy with a voice...
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is April 1st, and today on the show we're going to be talking about learning. Learning. So don't let anyone tell you this is a show about school. We're talking about learning. Now, we're going to do this from a variety of angles. The show is going to start out with about a 26, 27-minute clip of a live show that we did on March 21st. Osborne and I talk about learning theories, and we were prompted to do so by a listener named John, who posted in our libertarian teachers group at schoolsucksproject.com an infographic with the popular learning theories. So this is behaviorism, cognitivism, constructivism, and a newer learning theory called connectivism. So the way we decided to discuss this, to try and make it as interesting as possible, I dug up a paper, just a sort of an informal introductory paper that I wrote in graduate school in 2002, called My Philosophy of Education, which talks about behaviorism and constructivism. After that, I will come back and we will talk about this new theory, connectivism, and we'll point out some of the flaws with the three most popular learning theories, or the three most well-known learning theories. I don't know if any of them are particularly popular, behaviorism, constructivism, and cognitivism. After that, that kind of closes the book on learning theories, we will move on to learning styles, and we'll examine that concept very briefly. And then in the end, we'll talk a little bit about learning strategies. So I hope this is useful information, and I will put a link to this infographic and this discussion in our forums at schoolsucksproject.com if you want to check it out for yourself. So that's it. And stick around after, because I'll preview some more AV Club bonus content. All right. Anyway, here's the show. Thanks for listening. More stuff coming soon. Take care. There was a forum thread that I wanted to cover. It was called Learning Theories and Their Subsequent Pedagogy, Which is the Most Libertarian? So it goes through some of the learning theories that we've talked about on the show before. And if you're unfamiliar with what learning theories are, this would be like behaviorism versus constructivism, which is really the pair that we were taught about when I was a grad student. Those were like the two schools of thought in how learning and teaching should work. So from Wikipedia, real quick, a learning theory, conceptual frameworks that describe how information is absorbed, processed, and retained during learning. Cognitive, emotional, and environmental influences, as well as prior experience, all play a part in how understanding or worldview is acquired or changed, and how knowledge and skills are retained. Behaviorists look at learning. So then it goes into behaviorism, constructivism, and cognitivism. So we've talked a lot on the show about behaviorism. Are you familiar? The Skinners?
Sure.
And the Pavlovs. And John Watson. People needed to be conditioned, essentially. And this was divided into classical conditioning, where behavior becomes a reflex response to a stimulus, like those dogs and the dinner bell. And operant conditioning, where there is reinforcement of the behavior by a reward or a punishment, which is today called school. I think we associate Pavlov more with the classical and Skinner more with operant. So this seems to us very objectionable. The remedy for this supposedly was called constructivism. Mm-hmm. And constructivism is really tied to progressive, more student-centered. People might say Sudbury is a constructivist model. And it's really caught on. I mean, they're really speaking this language in the discussions about pedagogy all the way up to the academic graduate level. But the problem with constructivism is that it is missing the objectivist model of obtaining knowledge. You know, you get into this real, well, could we really know anything kind of thinking. So that's been the craze in education for several decades right now. And this was the dichotomy that they were giving to us in university back when I was a graduate student about 11 years ago. John posted this forum thread. And again, if you want to go and check this out for yourself, it is in the Libertarian Teachers group on schoolsucksproject.com. And it is called Learning Theories Every Teacher Should Know. And it's really pretty much an infographic. It deals with learning theories, internal and external, the traditional theories of behaviorism, cognitivism, and constructivism, and adding for the digital age, connectivism. Let me just read a definition for cognitivism first, because it's kind of lumped with the other two that are more traditional, behaviorism and constructivism. And then let's talk a little bit about connectivism. Then I have a little treat for everyone.
Can't wait for treats.
Yeah. Cognitivism. Cognitive theories grew out of Gestalt psychology, developed in Germany in the early 1900s and brought to America in the 1920s. The German word Gestalt is roughly equivalent to the English configuration or pattern and emphasizes the whole human experience. Over the years, the Gestalt psychologists provided demonstrations and described principles to explain the way we organize our sensations into perceptions. Gestalt psychologists criticized behaviorists for being too dependent on overt behavior to explain learning. They proposed looking at the patterns rather than isolated event. Gestalt views of learning have been incorporated into what some have come to label cognitive theories. Two key assumptions underlined this cognitive approach: that the memory system is an active, organized processor of information, and that prior knowledge plays an important role in learning. Cognitive theories look beyond behavior to consider how human memory works to promote learning, and an understanding of short-term memory and long-term memory is important to educators influenced by cognitive theory. They view learning as an internal mental process, including insight, information processing, memory, and perception, where the educator focuses on building intelligence and cognitive development. The individual learner is more important than the environment. That sounds very un-German to me. You know, when you first, well, I mean, when you hear it's about, it's, you know, an educational theory that came from Germany, I guess I just have this bias where that's not going to be good, you know, considering.
Especially if it came in the 20s.
Now, I had moved recently. And I had lots of boxes, books and papers. I went through some of these boxes and I found this folder of papers that I had written in an intro to education class in 2002. Very confused. And the professor was encouraging that she was the kind of woman with like a long, she would wear like a long floral skirt and she would have a great deal of beaded jewelry.
Nice.
And, you know.
Did she have an odor?
Like patchouli?
You tell me.
No offense if you wear patchouli, anybody, but she was very much, this was the class where we sang the Union songs.
Oh.
From the 30s.
Joy.
So that tells you a little bit about something, about what was going on in that class and what the message was. She was also one of those people who wrote the textbook. I noticed that my papers have numerous citations with her name in them, which she probably really appreciated. And this is why a lot of people are attracted to this profession.
What did you get on this paper?
I don't know. They don't appear to be graded.
Oh.
Let me see. The one that I wanted to read was My Philosophy of Education by Brett Vanat, written 11 years and 2 weeks ago to the day, March 7th, 2002. And it's just two short pages. I thought I would read it. And it's I'm really kind of embarrassed for myself here. But it also has some interesting, it has a couple of promising sentences in it. Hmm. So I thought this might be a better jumping off point for our discussion than actually going through this infographic, but I definitely recommend that people check it out. And after I go through this, which deals with the more traditional schools of thought in learning theories, we will jump on connectivism.
Sure.
And explore that. Here's another thing, folks. We've remedied the phone problems that we've been suffering through for several weeks now. So if you want to give us a call and contribute to this conversation, 843, join SSP. You could Skype in at School Sucks Live.
Are you going to read the paper in the voice of young Brett Vanat?
It probably sound a lot like Larry the Liberal. My Philosophy of Education. At this point, my philosophy includes elements of several others. Most of my current beliefs lean towards, guess what?
Behaviorism. Yeah.
Although this is a change that has come quite recently. As a secondary history teacher, I feel that my philosophy should also incorporate some of the ideas of postmodernism and the theory of social reconstructionism. I don't remember what that is. It does sound really bad. It sounds terrible. Here's what the chat is for. If somebody wants to look up social reconstructionism and throw a definition into the chat in all caps, I know that's kind of a tall order. Until I did my research for the debate on student-centered versus teacher-centered teaching, I was really in favor of a more progressive constructivist classroom. Now, constructivist, again, is just tied to student-centered. I mean, that would probably be the best shorthand for that. Built on the work of Jean Piaget and Jerome Bruner, constructivism emphasizes the active involvement of learners in constructing knowledge for themselves. So constructing knowledge for themselves was where this becomes problematic, because obviously it implies that learners would have a lot of freedom like they do at Sudbury, but constructing their own knowledge and saying to some authority figure, look at this knowledge that I made. And they say, oh, that's very good knowledge. Good job. You made it all by yourself. That's not how the world works.
The ocean is made of donuts.
That's not how the world works, folks, if you're new. And building new ideas and concepts based on current knowledge and past experience. It asks why students do not learn deeply by listening to a teacher or reading from a textbook. So there are parts of this that are really not bad. The problem was that when it was applied to the government school pedagogy, it just wound up being this cluster F where people could do whatever. You know, Billy Madison painted the duck blue because he always wanted to see a blue duck, and the teacher pats him on the head. That's constructivism. Is there anything else that really is pertinent information here? No, I mean, so people get the idea. We've talked about this before. Let me start the second paragraph again. Until I did my research on the debate for student-centered versus teacher-centered, or in other words, constructivism versus behaviorism, I was really in favor of the more progressive constructivist classroom. Progressivism seems very idealistic and the warmest approach to educating children. The reason why I favored a student-centered model was it seemed to be the only way children could have a chance to completely enjoy their schooling. Also, because I am very impressionable early on in my study of education, I had decided that I should follow what seems to be popular belief. Now, how about that? That's a nice insight for a dumb little kid. Recognizing in college that I am impressionable. I think a lot of these college kids, they come home and they're like, let me tell you now, about...
Were you saying that, though, because that's what the teacher wanted you to say and she was impressing upon you that that's how you should think?
Whoa. However, when I reflected upon my own experience as a college student, I realized that my favorite teacher, Mr. Breida, had a philosophy rooted in direct instruction. Now, direct instruction ties to behaviorism because it's basically an adult at the front of the room controlling everything that goes on. So all the variables are basically controlled by them. Now, this is how all college classes work, pretty much, where a professor is at a podium and, you know, you want to do well, you basically agree with him. It's not how all college classes work, but it's a common theme at the university level where professors are giving you textbooks that they wrote as if it is an objective treatment of the subject you're learning about.
I remember getting very frustrated whenever the professor would deviate from that particular way of doing things. Like, yeah, no, you discuss amongst yourselves. That would make me very uncomfortable.
Why?
Because I am paying you to tell me what to think. You tell me what to think, I will write it down on a paper during a test, and I will get an A.
Wow.
Don't make me have to, like, engage the material myself. That's ridiculous.
Sure.
That's what we do outside of class.
Okay, all right. Yeah, that makes sense. And I'll tell you how I would actually agree with that. There was this boy in a lot of my history classes, and his name was Walter. Now, I went to a small school. It was maybe like 1,500 kids. So most of the classes were small. They were less than 50 people. And you could know everyone's name. And Walter thought he knew a lot about history. And the professor, Mr. Breida.
That's hilarious you call 50 a small class. I don't think I've ever been in a class that large.
Well, no, I mean, I just think about, like, I go to UNH. I've, like, tutored kids at UNH. They have these lecture halls that seat, like, 300 people.
Wow.
Yeah.
Crazy.
So, and whenever you see college in a movie.
The idea that you're paying for that is really creepy to me. Like, why on earth wouldn't you be buying a YouTube video instead?
Well, that's, like,
if you're going to be talking to that many people at the same time.
Right. Yeah, I
ridiculous.
Understand.
Ridiculous.
Right. But I would say a lot of my classes were between 20 and 35.
Okay.
And the biggest any would be pushed would be like to 50. Walter would always like to spoil. Breida would tell the story. You know, mm-hmm. He'd like want to tell, like really have it be this tale, you know, and it would be very dramatic. And he would talk about the Civil War, and his depth of knowledge was so impressive on so many subjects. And this is why he probably had such a big influence on me. But Walter would raise his hand and he would say, ooh, and then he died at Wounded Knee.
Mm-hmm.
And Breida would just shoot him this look like he wished he would die for spoiling his story that he wanted to tell. So I would be like kind of feeling the way you did, you know, where somebody would be ruining the narrative from the one person that I wanted to listen to. And Breida really, he was that sage on the stage. He had that command of the room. People respected him. And he was really hard, really challenging, and asked a lot of us, but people really liked his classes. So, however, when I reflected upon my own experience as a college student, I realized that my favorite teacher, Mr. Breida, had a philosophy rooted in direct instruction. Not only was his teaching extremely effective, but I also found the class very enjoyable, as I just explained to you and our audience in an anecdotal way. In the debate, I used a quote from Project Follow Through. I don't remember what that is.
that, quote, self-esteem appears to derive from pride in becoming competent in the important academic skills. That's what they would like us to think, I guess. This study focused on disadvantaged children K through 3, but it rang true for me. Until I started taking Mr. Brightest courses, I wasn't exactly a model student. However, once I started to experience success with very challenging subject matter, it seemed to spread throughout my learning. It's such a shame that this didn't happen in high school. Go to the chat. Anything fun? Anything relevant? Social reconstructionism is a philosophy that emphasizes the addressing of social questions and a quest to create a better society and worldwide democracy.
Oh, that sounds like Barack Obama's speech today in Israel.
He spoke in Israel?
Yeah.
Did he ride a donkey in? They say that's the sign of the apocalypse.
Oh.
And that he's the Antichrist. He didn't ride a donkey in?
No, I don't think so, but I'm glad you pulled that out of your eschatological roots there.
Yeah. Well, listen, if anybody hears about Obama on a donkey in Israel, text me or message me on Facebook so I can get some canned goods.
Yeah.
Because that means the apocalypse is here. Obama's the Antichrist. He rides into Israel on a donkey.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk of seeing the world how it is and also seeing how the world as it should be.
In Mr. Brightest class, we never got out of our desks and never worked in groups or did presentations. He talked and we took notes. I filled multiple notebooks for each class he taught. I still have them and I still read through them. Before I experienced any of these classes, they sounded dreadful. However, even though there was a lot required of us and a rather strict classroom atmosphere, Mr. Prida was so dynamic and intelligent that it became impossible to dread. It became the most exciting and enriching educational experience in my life. I should have added, until your class, Mrs. Shartok, liberal beaded jewelry wearing hippie textbook writer. Right.
So this paper should have been called Love Letter to Dr. Brada.
Brada? Yeah, Brada. I've never even followed up with this guy and told him what an influence he was. He might be horrified.
Dude, you should title the next podcast School Sucks Made Possible by Dr. Brada.
I should probably see what last I knew he was teaching. I think he went and taught in community college. Mm. Actually, they offered him some kind of deal he couldn't refuse.
That's where a lot of good teachers go because they're allowed to do what they want to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like anyone who's outside of the towing the party line of the mainstream.
Yeah.
They can go to that place as an outlet to do their more fringy, cool stuff.
Yeah, well, and that might have been him. He might have gotten some crap about some of the stuff he did, because I thought he was very revolutionary at the time. And I wonder what it became of him, not just, as a professor, but also ideologically. Did he change at all? I didn't get to include this inference in my closing argument in the debate, but it was this experience that helped me realize a new personal philosophy. I could identify with many of the ideas outlined in behaviorism. Some characteristics are the teacher should arrange conditions under which learning can occur. And that was a quote. And quote, students will learn best by the use of carefully planned schedules of reinforcement. Unquote. I also agree with the behaviorist call to embrace technology, to increase range as a teacher, and increase knowledge. That was kind of euphemism filled. Embrace technology, that's relatively uncontroversial. Mm-hmm. Increase range as a teacher and increase knowledge. That's pretty vacuous. I would mark myself down for that. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that any teaching philosophy dictates the personality a teacher displays to his students. There seems to be a misconception that instructivist teachers don't bring much personal warmth to the classroom. I believe that we should really strive to be dynamic and charismatic and to form solid relationships with our students. We should include personal stories and anecdotes when appropriate in an effort to show them our human side. However, the high school classroom needs structure. I think I was on my way. I think this shows, frankly, if I may, I think this shows a little bit of promise that I could someday.
Well, it's just the very notion that you were in the process of changing your ideas.
Yeah.
Just showing that you can change ideas is the first step. It's half the battle, if you will.
Of course, the thing
G.I. Joe would say.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, the thing that's missing from this is real choice. I mean, we see that this is a conversation that exists very much in a box, where what was presented to us as far as options with education were behaviorism, constructivism. This, I think, was around the point where I discovered Gatto, just Googling keywords from this class on the internet. Now, Gatto has talked about everything and is very generous with his books as far as making them available online as PDFs or on his website. So it was around this time, 2002, 2003, that year, that academic year, that I discovered Gatto. And I think I looked at it and said, well, that's interesting. School is kind of a conspiracy.
Wow. Yeah, jumped right out at you.
Wild. But then I think that idea got tabled for quite some time.
I see.
But it was around this time where it was brought to my attention. Okay.
Did he reel you in with tales of the Antichrist riding into Jerusalem on a donkey?
Which one?
John Taylor Gatto.
No. Oh. No. Never mentions it at all. He goes to some dark and spooky places, though.
Yes.
Gatto. Like when he's looking at the history. I mean, he gets into Fabian socialism, and he's thorough. He's definitely thorough. No Antichrist talk. I also like the idea of postmodernism, that education should challenge the status quo. Shartok, page 64. That was my teacher. Especially as a history teacher. In high school, many students are unaware of the revisionist model of American history. I believe this is why many lack interest, because they take what we have as Americans for granted, because more traditional American history implies that we deserve it. Manifest destiny and all that. Social reconstructionism is also important. I feel that high school history students should be looking at current events, and teachers should be leading discussions. Also, students should be encouraged to apply what they've learned about the past in an attempt to look for solutions in the problems of the present.
So I'm hearing a lot of I feel and I think in this paper. Is sure. This would be unheard of in my educational career. Like, you would never put the words I think anything.
This was a different kind of paper. Like, obviously, okay. If you're writing a position paper, which I also do, folks, if you're interested in what does Steph say? If you subscribe, he sends you his thesis. Hey, everybody, if you join the AV Club, I will send you position paper number 3, March 28th, 2002, Affirmative Action.
Oh, my.
I'll autograph a copy and send it right along. I'm sure it's a gem. I hope you don't mind that my photocopies will also have Eileen Shartok's notes on them.
Shartok sounds like a Star Trek name.
And they will smell a little bit like patchouli.
Shartok.
And,
when the walls fell.
Tofu. What?
Shartok?
I Jewish. Like a Star Trek? It's a Hebrew name,
okay.
I think.
Okay. Well, Gene Roddenberry, he was Jewish.
Something that he would name.
Yeah.
Hmm. I don't know. Last paragraph. I feel. Whoa. This is very now what I was saying in a position paper, obviously a position paper, you would never say, or any kind of persuasive essay, you would never say, I think, I feel, because it's already implied that if you're writing it, this is your opinion. But this was like a more personal and informal kind of writing exercise where it would be okay to say, I think, and I feel. Thanks. I feel that teachers who completely adhere to only one theory handicap themselves. I was upset when I was forced to take the negative stance for the debate, but it was a good thing that I did. I see the necessity of exploring many philosophies and embracing different elements in creating our own. By Brett Vanat.
Well, it's a good thing you embrace more philosophies.
No shit. My goodness. Okay, everyone. This is Brett. It's April 1st again. And that conversation went on a little while longer. And I, in the moment, I questioned, did I really embrace new theories? I mean, one of the reasons I think in that paper why I was trying to justify behaviorism is because it was the most teacher-centered model, where the teacher was able to control all the variables in the learning environment. And here I am, as a podcaster, controlling most of the variables. And of course, in recent times, with the live show and a more interactive website, obviously we're trying to change that. And I actually think
that this show reflects that, considering that the entire topic for the show was user-generated. Even some of the articles that I'm going to add at this point came to me from listeners. So that conversation did go on, though, for a while. And if you want to hear the whole thing, it is on our YouTube page. It is called School Sucks TV Number 7, Learning Theories. But I found an article on elearnspace.org that introduces this fourth learning theory. The title of this piece is Connectivism, a Learning Theory for the Digital Age. This was actually written 8 years ago. So the introduction. Behaviorism, cognitivism, and constructivism are the three broad learning theories most often utilized in the creation of instructional environments. These theories, however, were developed in a time when learning was not impacted through technology. Over the last 20 years, technology has reorganized how we live, how we communicate, and how we learn. Learning needs and theories that describe learning principles and processes should be reflective of underlying social environments. This next line is a reference to a 1996 study called Learning as a Way of Being by P.V. Vail. Vail emphasizes that learning must be a way of being, an ongoing set of attitudes and actions by individuals and groups that they employ to try to keep abreast of the surprising, novel, messy, obtrusive, recurring events. Learners as little as 40 years ago would complete the required schooling and enter a career that would often last a lifetime. Information development was slow. The life of knowledge was measured in decades. Today, these foundational principles have been altered. Knowledge is growing exponentially. In many fields, the life of knowledge is now measured in months and years. Gonzalez, another study they're citing here, describes the challenges of rapidly diminishing knowledge life. Quote, one of the most persuasive factors is the shrinking half-life of knowledge. The half-life of knowledge is the time span from when the knowledge is gained to when it becomes obsolete. Half of what is known today was not known 10 years ago. The amount of knowledge in the world has doubled in the past 10 years and is doubling every 18 months, according to the American Society of Training and Documentation. To combat the shrinking half-life of knowledge, organizations have been forced to develop new methods of deploying instruction, unquote. That was written in 2004. So then it gives a list some significant trends in learning. Many learners will move into a variety of different, possibly unrelated fields over the course of their lifetime. This is even more true now than it was when this was written just a few years ago. Two, informal learning is a significant aspect of our learning experience. Formal education no longer comprises the majority of our learning, if it ever did. I added that part when I went, if it ever did. Learning now occurs in a variety of ways, through communities of practice, personal networks, and through completion of work-related tasks. Three, learning is a continual process, lasting for a lifetime. Learning and work-related activities are no longer separate. In many situations, they are the same. Four, technology is altering, rewiring our brains, the tools we use to define and shape our thinking. Five, the organization and the individual are both learning organisms. Increased attention to knowledge management highlights the need for a theory that attempts to explain the link between individual and organizational learning. Six, many of the processes previously handled by learning theories, especially in cognitive information processing, can now be offloaded to or supported by technology. And seven, know-how and know-what is being supplemented with know-where, the understanding of where to find knowledge needed. Okay, so I understand this is a little bit dated, but many of us are old enough to remember a time when something needed to get done. We needed to go and find the person who had the know-how. And today, we have this phrase, many of you probably grew up with it, Google it, where all you have to do is know where and you can find and have that information for yourself. I mean, this is, people are using this to, not that I always recommend it, but, you know, diagnose minor medical issues, diagnose automotive problems, where before this information was monopolized. And I think, unfortunately, still there's a lot of people today who aren't utilizing this and are still over trusting of quote unquote experts. And certainly there are people who are experts, and there are situations which require the expertise of others. But we used to have to go on a hunt. We would have to grab our wallets and get in our cars and go on a hunt for the person who had the know what and the know how. And there's less of that today because we have this skill of the know where to find that information. So the article from there, it goes on to discuss the background on the three dominant theories that we have already talked about: behaviorism, constructivism, and cognitivism. And it also discusses some of the limitations of those theories. First and foremost, or as the article says, the popular learning theories all suggest that learning occurs inside a person. And what this is suggesting is that today, because of these advances, learning now occurs outside of people, and the learning theories also fail to deal with how learning happens in organizations. So it makes a good point, too, that once you apply the impact of technology, so we're talking just in the last couple decades, to these theories that are all older than that, they don't seem to be as tenable as they once were. It also makes a really good point, as things change, that theorists have this inclination to continue to just revise and try to change and maybe even evolve theories to fit the conditions of new times. But at some point, these things have changed so much that continuing to modify a theory just doesn't make sense anymore. And this is how they introduced the idea, or the learning theory of connectivism, by saying sometimes, you know, things have changed so much that you just have to start from scratch. So new heading, an alternative theory, including technology and connection making as learning activities, begins to move learning theories into a digital age. We derive our competence from forming connections. Karen Stevenson states, quote, "Experience has long been considered the best teacher of knowledge. Since we cannot experience everything, other people's experience, and hence other people, become the surrogate for knowledge. I store my knowledge in my friends is an axiom for collecting knowledge through collecting people," unquote. Chaos is a new reality for knowledge workers. Science Week in 2004 quoted Nigel Calder's definition that chaos is, quote, "a cryptic form of order." Chaos is the breakdown of predictability, evidenced in complicated arrangements that initially defy order. Unlike constructivism, which states that learners attempt to foster understanding by meaning-making tasks, chaos states that the meaning exists. The learner's challenge is to recognize the patterns which appear to be hidden. Meaning-making and forming connections between specialized communities are important activities. Now, at this point, I want to stop. I am going to share more of this article with you, but I have some thoughts. Some are positive, some are negative, and I think they're important to share. First of all, this introduction for me to this idea of connectivism jogged my memory. I remember it was probably 4 months ago. I was at UNH and I was meeting with this girl who was a genetics student, and she was just having the most difficult time. I think she was a sophomore, and she just hadn't really adapted to college life. And I asked her this one question. It was a simple question, and it really just blew her mind. And I don't mean that in a way where it was just like this beautifully profound question, or like she was an idiot and it blew her mind. It was a very simple question. I think it was just very rare. I don't think I had ever really asked it of anybody else in a similar situation. And she told me as much, that she had never been asked anything like this when confronting challenges she had with academics. And I think it was something like, have you ever thought about how you learn or about how you've learned to learn through the environments that you've, you know, pretty much been forced to be in for the 12 years prior to attending college? Is what you learned about how to learn still relevant? Now, this girl might have been 20. And I think the older that you are, the more important this question is. It might sound like an incredibly simple and obvious question, right? Especially, I mean, with what we talk about here, like, yeah, Brett, we're, you know, basically made into these sort of inactive buckets that just sit there and people pour information into it. And it's not a cooperative or active process for us at all. Yeah, and of course we have to move on beyond that to be active learners and take charge of that experience. But I think that some of these habits are very, very well ingrained. Now, the positive thing about this introduction to connectivism is that maybe some people have never thought about the game has changed, right? And we're still trying to work with old patterns of thinking and learning and apply them to a time where those patterns are no longer relevant. The challenge, the negative thoughts that I have about connectivism is it seems to shift away from the embrace of self-directed learning, right? When we're talking, because I'm just looking at this next paragraph that I'm about to get into, and things start to get a little bit fruity and a little bit distanced from where I like to be. But I don't want to stop. I don't want to not include this. I just want to preface, as I continue to read, that there are certainly a lot of questions and, from what I can tell, a lot of caveats. And maybe I shouldn't say fruity. I mean, for me, fruity, I guess that can mean many things. But for me, fruity is kind of a synonym for new agey. And I just think maybe a more accurate word is there's an ominousness to the description where there's a shift away from independence and self-reliance. Right? Because we can be like what I talked about in the example of Google It, that is more about you know, getting more information for ourselves or being empowered by having access to information. Not as I could see this being twisted. I'm sorry if I'm being a cynical man, but I could see this being twisted into like, oh, well, you don't need to have any depth of knowledge anywhere because we have this interconnectivity, this interdependence. I do not like the word interdependence. I don't know what you think of it. It makes me nervous. Okay, or network-driven learning versus individual or learner-driven educational experiences. So I want to continue. I just want you to know that I'm sitting here a little bit nervous as I read this. It doesn't mean there isn't valuable information here. I think more research is going to be required. So chaos as a science recognizes the connection of everything to everything. Glick, 1987, states, quote, in weather, for example, this translates to what is only half-jokingly known as the butterfly effect, the notion that a butterfly stirring the air today in Peking can transform storm systems the next month in New York, unquote. This analogy highlights a real challenge. Quote, sensitive dependence on initial conditions profoundly impacts what we learn and how we act based on our learning. This is something I think, just jump away one more second, this is something I think that is real and we need to be aware of. Decision making is indicative of this. If the underlying conditions used to make decisions change, the decision itself is no longer as correct as it was at the time it was made. The ability to recognize and adjust to pattern shifts is a key learning task. Luis Mateus Roca, 1998, defines self-organization as the, quote, spontaneous formation of well-organized structures, patterns, or behaviors from random initial conditions, unquote. Learning as a self-organizing process requires that the system, personal or organizational learning systems, quote, be informationally open. That is, for it to be able to classify its own interaction with an environment, it must be able to change its structure, unquote. Wiley and Edwards acknowledge the importance of self-organization as a learning process. Quote, Jacobs argues that communities self-organize is a manner similar to social insects. Instead of thousands of ants crossing each other's pheromone trails and changing their behavior accordingly, thousands of humans pass each other on the sidewalk and change their behavior accordingly, unquote. Self-organization on a personal level is a microprocess of the larger self-organizing knowledge constructs created within corporate or institutional environments. The capacity to form connections between sources of information and thereby create useful information patterns is required to learn in our knowledge economy. Next heading, networks, small worlds, weak ties. A network can simply be defined as connections between entities. Computer networks, power grids, and social networks all function on the simple principle that people, groups, systems, nodes, entities can be connected to create an integrated whole. Alterations within the network have ripple effects on the whole. Albert Laszlo Barabasi states that, quote, nodes always compete for connections because links represent survival in an interconnected world, unquote. This competition is largely dulled within a personal learning network, but the placing of value on certain nodes over others is a reality. Nodes that successfully acquire greater profile will be more successful at acquiring additional connections. In a learning sense, the likelihood that a concept of learning will be linked depends on how well it is currently linked. Nodes, which can be fields, ideas, community, that specialize and gain recognition for their expertise, have greater chances of recognition, thus resulting in cross-pollination of learning communities. What is this reminding you of? I'm not even going to say it. I think we're on the same page here. Comment on, when I post this, comment one word. Tell me what that reminds you of. That would be an interesting experiment. Please do that. Weak ties are links or bridges that allow short connections between information. Our small world networks are generally populated with people whose interests and knowledge are similar to ours. Finding a new job, as an example, often occurs through weak ties. This principle has great merit in the notion of serendipity, innovation, and creativity. Connections between disparate ideas and fields can create new innovations. So here we go. This is the principles of connectivism, and then I'm going to move on. Connectivism is the integration of principles explored by chaos, network, and complexity, and self-organization theories. Learning is a process that occurs within nebulous environments of shifting core elements, not entirely under the control of the individual. Learning, defined as actionable knowledge, can reside outside of ourselves, within an organization or database, is focused on connecting specialized information sets, and the connections that enable us to learn more are more important than our current state of knowing. Connectivism is driven by the understanding that decisions are based on rapidly altering foundations. New information is continually being acquired. The ability to draw distinctions between important and unimportant information is vital. The ability to recognize when new information alters the landscape based on decisions made yesterday is also critical. The principles of connectivism. Number one, learning and knowledge rests in diversity of opinions. Two, learning is a process of connecting specialized nodes or information sources. Three, learning may reside in non-human appliances. Four, capacity to know is more critical than what is currently known. Five, nurturing and maintaining connections is needed to facilitate continual learning. Six, the ability to see connections between fields, ideas, and concepts is a core skill. Seven, currency, which they define as accurate, up-to-date knowledge, is the intent of all connectivist learning theories. And 8, decision-making is itself a learning process. Choosing what to learn and the meaning of incoming information is seen through the lens of a shifting reality. While there is a right answer now, it may be wrong tomorrow due to alterations in the information climate affecting the decision. Connectivism also addresses the challenges that many corporations face in knowledge management activities. Knowledge that resides in a database needs to be connected with the right people in the right context in order to be classified as learning. Behaviorism, cognitivism, and constructivism do not attempt to address the challenges of organizational knowledge and transference. Information flow within an organization is an important element in organizational effectiveness. In a knowledge economy, the flow of information is the equivalent of an oil pipe in an industrial economy. Creating, preserving, and utilizing information flow should be a key organizational activity. Knowledge flow can be likened to a river that meanders through the ecology of an organization. In certain areas, the river pools, in other areas, it ebbs. The health of the learning ecology of the organization depends on effective nurturing of the information flow. Social network analysis is an additional element in understanding learning models in a digital era. Art Kleiner, in 2002, explores Karen Stevenson's, quote, quantum theory of trust, which explains not just how to recognize the collective cognitive ability of an organization, but how to cultivate and increase it. Within social networks, hubs are well-connected people who are able to foster and maintain knowledge flow. Their interdependence results in effective knowledge flow, enabling the personal understanding of the state of activities organizationally. The starting point of connectivism is the individual. Personal knowledge is comprised of a network which feeds into organization and institutions, which in turn feed back into the network and continue to provide learning to the individual. This cycle of knowledge development, personal to network to organization, allows learners to remain current in their field through the connections they have formed. The pipe is more important than the content within the pipe. Our ability to learn what we need for tomorrow is more important than what we know today. A real challenge for any learning theory is to actuate known knowledge at the point of application. When knowledge, however, is needed but not known, the ability to plug into sources to meet the requirements becomes a vital skill. As knowledge continues to grow and evolve, access to what is needed is more important than what the learner currently possesses. Connectivism presents a model of learning that acknowledges the tectonic shifts in society where learning is no longer an internal, individualistic activity. How people work and function is altered when new tools are utilized. The field of education has been slow to recognize both the impact of new learning tools and the environmental changes in what it means to learn. Connectivism provides insight into learning skills and tasks needed for learners to flourish in a digital era. The end. So, to return to the question that was originally asked in the forum, which one of these theories, behaviorism, cognitivism, constructivism, or connectivism, is the most libertarian? I don't think it's a terribly controversial statement for me to say that most philosophers, most psychological schools of thought, or educational schools of thought, put much of a premium on individual liberty. At least, I mean, judging by the world in which we live, it hasn't been a huge priority in the prevailing schools of thought. Otherwise, I think the world would look a lot different. But it's also fair to say that most theories, I think, and most schools of thought begin with good intentions. And theories are flexible, malleable, interpretable, and misinterpretable. And people who might have started with pretty good intentions might have watched, if they live long enough, their ideas be taken to some pretty wacky and really disastrous and devastating places. But the reason why I mention the good intentions is that each one of these theories might have some redeeming features. Of course, none of these theories are libertarian on their own. And if we get into this maybe more from an epistemological point of view, when we're talking about self-sufficiency in knowledge, which I think is very important, we can set objectivism obviously as the standard, and we can try to compare. And what I mean by that, maybe just to flesh that out a little bit better, if objectivism gives us the best chance to achieve cognitive liberty, combining reason and empiricism and stripping out fancy and fantasy and mythology to give us the clearest picture of reality, well, as far as a knowledge acquisition strategy, that path to cognitive liberty probably continues on eventually to personal liberty. And then much further down that path, you might find political liberty. So there's some definitions that might lead us more towards an answer of which learning theory is the most libertarian, even though I'm the more I talk and listen to my voice, the more I'm thinking that specific question doesn't have an answer. But it doesn't mean we can't continue talking about this. So behaviorism actually connects to objectivism. Learning theory number one, behaviorism actually connects to objectivism. Bear with me here. Through the acknowledgement that reality is an objective absolute that exists outside of us. Reality is external. But the problem with behaviorism is it doesn't deal with internal processes. I mean, one of the problems, Jesus. Behaviorism treats human beings like stimulus-response machines, input-output machines, right? So knowledge is external, reality is external, and knowledge can be gained through experience is partly true, but it's missing the part that's probably picked up by cognitivism, where this incorporates higher mental processes in reasoning, right? So if you combine behaviorism, you know, reality is absolute, is external, it exists outside of us, and we can know it not just through experience, but also through a reasoning process where knowledge is achieved through negotiating the experience and the thinking about the experience, which is covered in cognitivism, but then also to deal with constructivism, the creativity, this is maybe moving away from the epistemological a little bit more here, but giving learners freedom, you know, not making them subject to a more collectivist, in its purest form, constructivism, integrated, interdependent kind of environment, that they exist as independent learners, that they can be self-directed. The problem is if you have that environment, which constructivism dictates, without the behaviorist and cognitive aspect, in other words, that there is a standard for reality. So you can't just be like, oh, what did Osborne say? The ocean is made of donuts. And then somebody gives you a sticker and a cookie because that's very cute and clever. That's not okay. So if we incorporate, the learner-driven environment or the learner-driven attitude versus the teacher-centered or curriculum-centered or state standard-centered model, that's a nice place to start. That's a nice foundation. But then the behaviorist aspect that reality is external and real and knowable, and the cognitive aspect that reality can be worked with through reason, well, all three of those combine to something that, you know, if you take the best parts of each, you can kind of get objectivism. But if you split them into these three disparate, distinct schools of thought on educational or learning theory, it's no good. Oh, that was a mess. So here's another way, another shorter, maybe more succinct description of that. There's a quote I've used on the show before. He was a Holocaust survivor. I think he was a doctor. His name was Viktor Frankl. I'm paraphrasing the quote. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space, just to make this extra relevant to today's question, there is your freedom. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space is your freedom. So behaviorism treats human beings like I said, stimulus-response mechanism with no space in between. You program an input and you get the desired output. So through cognitivism, now that space between opens up, right? Behaviorism still holds in that there is real stimulus and real response that have consequences in a real objective world. But now we're opening a space where those higher mental processes can take place. And maybe constructivism allows us to have an environment where that space between stimulus and response can get a little damn respect. How about that? But the full title of this thread is Learning Theories and Their Subsequent Pedagogies. And therein lies the rub with the teaching. Because where does teaching happen? Once you put any of these theories, like let's say they're all perfect, and then you try to insert them into a coercive environment like the government schools, what does it matter? And I think that's the arena in which most of these discussions take place. So behaviorism is probably the hardest as far as a learning theory, the hardest to justify, treating people like pigeons and mice. But even if the other two standard theories, constructivism and cognitivism, were formulated with the best of intentions, when they go into the government schools, as they have, they can all be corrupted. And I referenced this in a show called No Child Left Behind and Other Bipartisan Educational Conspiracies, and another show called Behaviorism in Disguise. Education, quote unquote, and by that I mean government school, but most people call it education, is always that tool, that weapon that interest groups are going to want to grab and use. And those groups, you know, they started out pretty silly. Religious folks, phrenologists, the Ku Klux Klan. And today, if you look at how much that this system, this bureaucracy has expanded, it goes up to the United Nations. So every time there's any discussion, and like I said, this is the arena in which these discussions exist. I know it was not the discussion that John the Poster was trying to have, but the reason why there is a debate is it centers around optimizing the government school experience, or at the very least in institutionalized, collectivized school settings. That was the discussion we were having in graduate school. That's the discussion they're having in, you know, educational policy. But it's all about sharpening the weapon, because all of these theories, schools were very behaviorist. Schools were very constructivist. I don't see a lot of evidence of cognitivism being involved, you know, maybe until recently, which it was perverted to label and drug kids. But whenever they talk about this optimization, none of that, I've been saying this for years, none of that makes me like optimistic about the future of coercive school. Because all it is a discussion about sharpening that weapon that schooling is to be used against innocent people. And that's all it will ever be. Am I a cynic? Sorry. You know what? I think we're going to do this as a two-parter. Today we did learning theories. In the next show, I want to talk a little bit, continuing this discussion, about learning styles and learning strategies. I've got some other things that I've got to do today, so I hope that's okay. We'll pick it up right there either tomorrow or the next day. For now, I'll give you, 15, 20 more minutes of show here. This is a clip from the After School Sucks special. It was after that live show that you've already heard a clip of in this show, March 21st. And I hope that including these clips at the end of each podcast will help more people realize that this is a real thing. This huge section with tons of extra content. I put it all in my car and drove it to the dump where they have that scale you can drive your car onto. It was literally tons. That's a joke. But I'll tell you this. We asked for $6 a month, the price of a cup of coffee at Starbucks. When I first thought of that, that was also a joke. But now there actually is like a $6 or $7 coffee at Starbucks. I don't recommend you spend your money on that. Get a Keurig. I hope you enjoy it. More stuff coming soon. Thanks for listening and take care.
I'm telling you, you'd love Rogan. Rogan will do 3 hours.
Oh.
Now, does he do once a week?
No, he does like three times a week. It's pretty much like his bread and butter right now. I mean, he still does like stand up, and he has a fitness like supplement company called onit.com. But the podcast is pretty much his full-time gig. He'll get nice and baked and have a really good conversation. Now, Rogan doesn't have... I this is what I was saying before about Rogan, is that he doesn't seem to be... He doesn't seem to have anything at the center of all of his thinking. Like, I didn't for so long. So everything can be explored. And I think that what would be ideal is to be able to have something anchoring your thinking, like, you know, objectivism, the non-aggression principle, property rights. Like, it's good if you can always keep those things at this in the center, but still be willing to at least entertain all kinds of ideas. And even if you, you know, you do adhere to the objectivist philosophy, if somebody wants to talk to me about ghosts, I'll talk to them about friggin' ghosts for an hour.
Sure.
You know, and maybe there's something educational in it. One of the most educational experiences that I had was with an 8-year-old boy. You know, I had some of the most exciting, they weren't always like learning experiences, but there was a lot of learning in that for me about astronomy and Project Disclosure, where they want the government to declassify all this UFO stuff. Oh. I learned working with that boy and looking at his, you know, his interest in UFOs and aliens. We researched this thing called Project Disclosure, where there's some guy who was an MD, emergency room doctor, left that profession to do research and put pressure on the government to open up these classified documents that they have. Through that, I learned how the hierarchy works of security and secrecy in government, and that there's like six security clearance levels above the president.
Really?
So this is like the plausible deniability thing, supposedly. Where,
I have that at my company.
What do you mean?
Like, there's things I don't want to know about.
Really?
Right.
That you delegate to other people.
Sure.
So, but these would be things that the president's security level, but you could, if you said, you could go in there and say, okay, everyone, we're changing shit. Now I need to know everything. The structure.
There's still people who know better than to let me know things.
But the structure of government does not allow the president to know certain things.
Interesting. So I never knew such a thing.
Can somebody?
I thought like once you get in that office, like they open the books to you. Like, here's all these things to know. So who gets these levels above the president? Are these like generals or like CIA directors or?
That's a good question. Unfortunately,
Is there someone with the clearance to know all and see all? Probably not, right? It's got to be like compartmentalized and stuff.
I think so, yeah. I wouldn't think, but we don't know. I mean, there could be whole branches, or not branches, but whole government departments that we don't even know exist.
Oh, that's certainly true.
And I mean, this guy, I forget his name, Steve something, and he was using a lot of trickery on Rogan to talking about his UFO stuff. And either he might be kind of like part shyster, part really believes it, but recognizes that some shystiness is needed to continue to push these ideas. Meredith says the prez is just a PR guy. No, I like that. I think there's definitely some truth to that
figurehead.
Yeah. I also Absolutely. Think that a lot of people, like, that's not serious power, right? Like, the president of the United States is kind of a clowny man, or maybe woman someday, right? Like, most of the people, a lot of, like, pretty dipshitty people have held that office. So everything couldn't be left in the hands of that person. Plus, it's a temporary job. So wouldn't there be a temptation to leave office and reveal a bunch of secrets for somebody because
why don't they blow the lid on that shit?
Yeah, because they don't know.
Right. They either don't know or they have some like serious shit held over their head, right?
Mm.
Like, I almost believe that like you aren't allowed in that place until people have enough dirt on you to just
that
really
makes sense.
Hold that over your head. Like, or maybe it's just blatant threat. Like, I will wipe your lineage from the face of the planet if you speak these words.
I don't know. By the way, yeah, I mean, I would think that that stuff is just intertwined with politics generally.
Like, you never see a president that doesn't have a family, right?
Who was Buchanan? Wasn't married? There, Garfield, one of them didn't have a wife. There was one president who was a bachelor who had never been married or anything. Hmm. But obviously that was going back, I think, 100 years, and a lot could have changed. Probably good for them to have a couple of little daughters.
Yeah. Well, they didn't even have like CIA back then, right?
No, the CIA was created after World War II, and it came out of something called the OSS, which was the Office of Strategic Services. And it's a real Nazi kind of thing. I'm just looking up levels of security clearance. Did you ever see that movie, The Good Shepherd?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that when we...
So pardon, you'll have to pardon me here. I'm trying to see if I can get like a... Top secret, more stringent clearance. A top secret TS clearance is often given as a result of single scope background investigation. Compartmented. As with TS clearances, sensitive compartmented information clearances are assigned only after one has been through the rigors of single scope background investigation and special adjudication process evaluating the investigation. Just give me like the list of levels. Individuals who had their security clearances revoked. John Deutsch, head of the CIA. Robert Oppenheimer.
My brother was denied top secret clearance in the military because of me. Or that's what he was told.
Really?
Yes. Your brother is involved in extremist groups and activities. That's what they told him.
Wow.
Yeah. That cool?
That is kind of cool. Somebody in the chat writes 1953. That might have been the origin of the CIA. It was the OSS before that. Brett, did you see the episode with Kokesh? No, what? The episode of what? That must have been weird. Oh, sorry, I jumped back. That must have been when Meredith asked, was he mad, your brother?
No, he thought it was amusing too.
Really?
Yeah. I don't think he actually wanted to do the job they were trying to clear him for.
Do you know what the job was?
I won't repeat it.
Yeah. Well, I used to deal with, when I was a recruiter, people had to have clearance to work on those nuclear sites.
Yeah.
So, I really want to find this list. Top secret, secret, confidential. There was like a whole tier of them, and I think they were numbered. Military operation by code name, NATO reporting name.
So are these levels of secrecy reasons why government people declare wars that are turn out to be unjustified in the...
Wait, because they don't have all the information?
For example, weapons of mass destruction, that kind of thing.
Well, this guy was actually, if you look at the weapons of mass destruction thing, the person who wound up getting shit all over for that was Tenet, right? Who was George Tenet, was the director of the CIA, where they said it was a slam dunk, right? So then all of these people who really aren't in the know, like Bush and Cheney and Colin Powell, kind of go and spread that information. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, well, wait a minute. We were told that the intelligence was good. Now, that whole thing could just be a bunch of BS, right? Yeah. It could all be nonsense. And that's probably, from what I've gathered, that's probably what's most likely. But this guy, Steve, whatever his name was, Stephen Greer. Okay. And this is not somebody that I'm taking incredibly seriously. He was the UFO guy. He was saying that he was allowed to brief one of the CIA directors on this UFO stuff, and his claim was that's above my clearance. So he's like, the things you're saying I don't know about. This is what he was told by the CIA director. And this guy was, he wasn't like, he didn't show up in a tinfoil hat and with notebooks, Mel Gibson style, he in conspiracy theory, but he was a serious man. He was an MD. And this kind of opened some doors for him. And he said, look, the things you're saying, his claim is that the CIA director said, things you're saying might be true, but what you're talking about, these kinds of projects, is not something that I have access to. So that's either above or it's compartmentalized.
Right. Well, the other thing that this buys these people, all the weird levels and matrices of secrecy, is that even if you are privy to information, you can claim that you're not, because no one will be able to know whether you are or not. Right? So like everyone's got plausible deniability, no matter what.
Right, because if you could say, because like if you're above the president, like let's say theoretically, I really wish I could find this out. If somebody can give me this information, it would be majestic. Okay, so then there is this thing, is the majestic like the government project that was supposed to be above everything where they were doing the UFO? Yes, that was called majestic. So, but what you're saying is in this little tier above the president that might be broken down, like those people could just be like, oh, it's above mine.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm the president. You're General Smith. I'll be like, hey, General Smith, I need to know about what's going on in Area 51. And you'd be like, yeah, I don't know. And then I'd be like, General Smithwick, what's going on in Area 51? I don't know.
Well, and the other thing too is that Area 51 is like a pop culture term. Mm-hmm. In the military term is Groom Lake.
Oh,
that's what they call it.
Oh,
so Area 51 is like so. The reason why I say that is it's because like most people are so clueless as to how all this works. It really doesn't even seem like they need to work that hard, even though they do, to protect information. You know, because like most people are like, well, they're president and he knows everything. You know, but he doesn't. I would think that the president is, somebody was saying, sometimes I forget who it was. I was listening to somebody recently that when they look at Obama giving a speech, they just see this like terrified, nervous guy, and who knows enough to just kind of know how impotent he really is in terms of any real change in the world.
I wonder at what point his mind was blown in that regard. Do you think that came before the whole presidency thing, during the campaign, after the fact? Like, did it take some time in office to realize, like, holy shit, there's nothing I can do here.
Like where his idealism just went out the window?
Right.
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, he was really riding the wave of not to make fun of him or his supporters, but it seemed like he was really riding a wave of hope and optimism into office. And I mean, he had enough exposure to government to understand that the changes that he was talking about, if he really believed that, right? Yeah. So,
well, I mean, he was a senator, right?
He was
must've got a taste of it there.
But the book that Dinesh D'Souza wrote about him is interesting too, because it suggests that he was just always like, wherever he went, the door was just opened for him in his like climb to power. That people, oh yeah, this would be a good guy to, you know, and it was just a very smooth path from, you know, being a community organizer to a state senator to getting in this absentee election to become the state, the regular senator of the two from Illinois, and then president. I mean, it's just very meteoric, his path. Mm. So I remember actually, this sounds like a crazy thing, but I remember seeing a news report about Obama, like a news package that had been put together by one of the major networks. And it was probably in 2002. So he was nobody. I swear this is true. I've looked online for it on one of my more conspiratorial nights, because I know this happened. And I remember, because it was so close to 9/11, that I thought it was interesting that his name rhymed with Osama. That's what seared it into my memory. Mm. But this was a news package that I saw on CNN or one of the major mainstream media networks. And it was about this young politician. And wouldn't it be neat if somebody like this was president? That was basically dead serious.
Oh,
totally true.
Mm. Laying the groundwork.
Somebody in the chat, James says in the chat, Obama, Biden, Osama bin Laden. Somebody else says they were groomed. He was groomed. They're all groomed. Somebody else says Majestic 12. Yep, that's what it is. I knew there was a number in it. Is the supposed code name of the alleged secret committee of scientists, military leaders, and government officials formed in 1947 by an executive order by President Harry S. Truman. The purpose of the committee would be to investigate the recovery of a UFO. Guessing FO. Yeah.